Coming to you from our studios in Dallas, Texas, and recorded live, Science News is on the air right now.
This is the promise of tomorrow, where people and industry keep up with the business of emerging and nanotechnologies. The fields covered in this series of programs will include energy, defense, aerospace, medicine, semiconductors, and more. For the next hour, Colonel Mason will introduce his experts, and you'll be on the cutting edge of the promise of tomorrow.
And of course, once again, it's so good to be back with you as we explore the exciting world of the business of emerging science, nanotechnology, open innovation, all sorts of wonderful things happening right here in the Science News Radio Network. And those of you listening on radio, you know you can also hear us commercial free online at thepromiseoftomorrow.biz. And if you go to our website, you're going to see on the right-hand side of your screen a link to a lot of the wonderful partners that we have here in the Science News Radio Network. And you'll be able to find links to the different trade shows and different events that are going on. We've got an exciting show today in the later on in the first half hour, and then in the second half hour we've got Carl Bloomfield. He's with Intertech. That's a testing organization. They do lots of stuff all over the world, and Carl is a lighting expert, and we wanted to find out more about organic lighting, and in addition to what's going on with LEDs and if they're going to replace the CFLs and those other things. So that's all coming up here in a little bit. And we've got a fascinating guest with Robin Gamble. He's the CEO of Persistent Telecom. That's the world's first mobile telephone network provider with a satellite backbone. Carl is particularly useful in the humanitarian area, and we're quite interested in talking more with him about what he's doing, because we're very involved with the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference going on in Seattle, Washington, October 21st through the 24th. And, of course, we're going to visit the Den of Strangers, get more wisdom from somebody a lot of us never heard of, visit our Fountain of Useless Information we have here on the set in the second half hour. And, of course, at the end of the program, listener comments with the voice of reason. But right now, let's get on to today's guest. All right. I want to introduce you at this particular time to Robin Gamble. He's CEO of Persistent Telecom, the world's first mobile phone network provider with a satellite backbone, and he's going to explain to us what that's all about. Welcome to the program, Robin.
Thank you.
Where are you right now? You're in your office in New Jersey?
Yes, sir.
Give us tell us about what's going on with Persistent Telecom. You talk about a NanoSat mobile phone network, NANO, capital S, capital A, capital T, and what is that, a NanoSat mobile phone network?
Going back just after September 11th, we were contracted by the Department of Defense to begin to build miniature portable mobile phone networks that could be put in a briefcase or a truck or an aircraft, so that they could set up ad hoc mobile phone networks to counter the threat of terrorism, both offensive and defensive sides. The private cell networks were pretty popular, and the next stage was to develop a way for multiple briefcases, if you will, to talk to each other. So we designed software that enables a couple of folks in a local area to have cell phone conversations or text messages or whatever, get their email. And then if they need to speak to someone that would be off that local network, they can push 9, get an outside line, if you will, and the call is forwarded over a satellite back to one of our two NOCs. We have one in Denver, and we have one in Sterling, Virginia. So the idea generally is that satellite communications are pretty expensive. If you and I each had an Iridium phone, and we were a mile apart, and we were talking to each other in a, I don't know, a catastrophe, a post-earthquake or tsunami kind of a scenario, you'd be paying $1 a minute, and I'd be paying $1 a minute to talk a mile away. Using the NanoSat technology, those calls have no cost, and we only pay for the calls that, you know, go to a further location or to another nanocell somewhere. And if the satellite cost is $5-6 a minute, it's really offset by all the improve productivity and communications in the local environment.
So this is a really a secured network of people that are not on the regular cell phone network, but a private network of telephones that work in, let's say, a particular area, but you have the ability to call really anywhere in the world with this network too?
Correct. The calls are forwarded over a satellite link, and they come to Earth in Colorado, where we can put them into the internet or into the public phone network.
Okay, so this would work in an area, let's say, where all the cell phone towers were down, or when you choose to do something highly private, is that right?
Yeah, for the military, it was developed for a whole list of requirements, but the next stage of evolution is exactly the one you alluded to with, if all the cell phone networks are down. Somewhere around the Asian tsunami, we started thinking that, if there were people in need of rescue, if those folks over there had, one of our systems, they could pick up 911 calls. And while we were, perfecting the satellite backhaul, Katrina hit. And that was kind of an exclamation point. If, police coppers could fly around and scoop up text messages from people trapped in attics or from folks that, were seeking rescue by dialing 911, we thought it would be a great disaster recovery. Since then, it's evolved into a couple other markets. There's a whole bunch of denied users that are too far off the grid for a commercial company to ever address. For, your AT&T to bring cell phone service to a ski resort somewhere that's 25 miles off their grid is really expensive. So for people that are drilling for natural gas, it can sometimes be an hour ride down the mountain just to get into phone service. So our small systems are low cost and can set up, small private networks for those types of areas. The most recent market that's developed is continuation of government and continuation of continuity of operations. The United States government, as do state and locals, have all kinds of requirements to be able to command, control, organize, execute in catastrophic situations. So we've been putting cell sites, private cell sites, in federal buildings and interconnecting them over satellite in the event that if the telephone grid goes down, they'd be able to still talk to each other. 50 key management personnel in each building have cell phones that are allowed on the private network.
All right, well, let's take a scenario. Let's say a poor place in developing a country ravaged by war in Sudan or something like that, where there's no cell phone towers and all communications are down, and a group has to move in, let's say a rescue group or something like that. They would move in with your briefcases, with your units, and would be able to communicate among themselves, and then any time that was necessary, that could be hooked to the international cell phone network around the world and make calls outside of that particular circle. Is that the picture I'm getting?
That's correct. But at the same time, while we were communicating, on the roll into the danger zone, whatever it was, we could be sending out text message to any cell phone that we find that says, if you need help, please respond, or the tsunami has passed, whatever kind of, messaging you'd like to do, and open it up to be able to receive information from folks.
So this would mean that my cell phone literally could be useful to me no matter where I happen to be in the world, as long as I had was in, let's use an old term, earshot, or let's say signal shot of your particular network that happened to be set up. Is that right?
Correct.
Wow.
In the commercial world, if you change countries, they want to authenticate you and make sure that, your bill is paid before they give you signal. Mm-hmm. But for disaster recovery and emergency operations and public safety and those types of things, there's no real commercial interest in receiving your phone call. So it's just give you signal. We don't care who you are. You can tell us after you dial the number.
Well, you've been doing this for a while then, developing these systems, and are you out aggressively marketing these things now? I mean, how does someone get in touch with you and they think they're going to need something like this, or is this something also that's going to be reactionary? In other words, nobody's interested in really having it until the time comes that there is a disaster, or these things that you're going to encourage people to, you know, organizations to have, cities and other places to have on hand for these disaster reliefs where it can be put in place anytime.
Yeah, you know, that's the first rule of insurance. Nobody has it until they need it, you know. So we don't really know how the market's going to respond. Like I stated, we developed it for the Department of Defense, but seem to think that there are a number of other markets that would be very very much assisted by this kind of technology. So we've been putting it on some cruise ships, although a lot of the current cruise ships have, you know, full-blown commercial type cell phone networks, but we've been working on some of the older ones. The the aircraft, you know, market is, you know, just starting to develop around the world, and we've been working with an airplane manufacturer. Remote and rural, we don't really know how big that market's going to be. Oil rigs, or, you know, ski resorts, or places that are just not financially feasible for a traditional cell phone carrier to invest the money it would take to put up the infrastructure. Certainly, public safety would be a great way for us to, you know, serve and do good at the same time. The and finally, the continuation of government market. Now that we've been approved for the first two sites, and that was a contract was awarded a year ago. Phase two is five more sites, and it's pretty undeniable how important it would be for the government to be able to turn the communications back on in the case of some sort of a disaster. Everyone talks about virus attacks. Everyone's concerned about attacks on your computer. But actually, the whole phone network is currently backboned by the Internet. So a denial-of-service attack on a major Internet switching center would pretty much take out all the phone calls.
Yeah, a terrorist, we've been real concerned about that. A terrorist group doing any number of different things, including the electrical grid and, of course, the communications, which is such a vital part of what all, you know, all the countries are involved in. And so this is really really something. And if we can protect our communications in time of attack, it's actually a very vital thing. I would presume that your court would be extremely useful to the Homeland Security.
That's what we're thinking, but, you know, these are big organizations, and takes a long time to, you know, get the message in there. We have met with some folks at the Defense Information Assurance folks, and also with Department of Homeland Security, and the wheels are just starting to turn.
Okay, and if somebody wants to know more information about the NanoSat mobile phone networks, you've got a website and places where people can find out more information. You want to give us that information right now?
Persistent-telecom.net.
All right, good. And then is there places where people can attend maybe some trade shows or something like that where they can see actual demonstrations right there?
We just did the cruise show in Miami. Next week I'm at a government show in Las Vegas. It's a pretty closed circle, that one. You know, I guess you just have to Google the web. I think I'm not even sure what our next... I'm sorry to say, I don't know what our next trade show is scheduled to be.
All right. Robin?
Pull out the 800 number and, you know, or send us an email at the Persistent Telecom website. We'd be happy to fill them in.
Well, it's fun to see you developing this and see you bringing it about. And, of course, it's always a development situation where you move as fast as you can and go after what customers that you can find where you can find them. And then all of a sudden, one day you're established and everybody knows your name, and then you're wanted everywhere.
That's what we're hoping for anyway.
Well, now, how about supply? What if overnight all of a sudden everybody says, look, we need you in these distressed humanitarian areas of the world, and we need you in these government areas where there could be some terrorist attacks and those sorts of things? Are you going to be able to supply big stuff on a pretty short notice?
We've got a number of what we call go boxes, and we've got phone lines reserved at our NOC. And, you know, you're real early on the curve here, so... we haven't gone with a full-blown, you know, advertising because we're not ready to take 10,000 calls. But certainly if something, you know, unfortunate were to happen tomorrow, an earthquake or something, we've got a half a dozen folks that are already ready to go wheels up and see if they can't help out. We've also, I don't know if you've ever heard of them, but we've also established a sort of a working agreement with Team Rubicon.
Mm-hmm.
Have you heard about these fellows?
No, I haven't. What is Team Rubicon?
They're mostly a bunch of former veterans and NGO types, doctors and communication specialists, and they work. They're funded, not for profit, and they've been jumping into Haiti and all kinds of places, going to the places that are most distressed, places that even, say, Red Cross couldn't reach out to. You might want to check them out on the web. Team Rubicon, a bunch of really, really, really quality folks, doing a lot of good for, you know, very little compensation.
So that's TeamRubicon.org or .com or what is it?
TeamRubiconUSA.org.
All right. That's R-U-B-I-C-O-N.
Correct.
All right. Got it, Robin. All right. You want to give us any predictions for the future? Do you have anything that you see? Or you'd like to put on the meditation cap there for a minute and predict something that you see maybe a few years down the line, either related to this or something else?
Well, the only thing I see is the only thing I don't want to see. If you're familiar with Conflicker or Stuxnet, if someone were to launch a denial of service on a major internet pop and take the internet down, say, you know, they say 90% of all internet comes through the United States at some point. So if they slowed that down 30%, you know, you wouldn't be able to use your Easy Pass to go through the toll. You wouldn't be able to pay for the gas at the pump or check out of the hotel or cash your passport through to get on an airplane. And as soon as the internet slowed down and all those people were queuing up, people would start clicking more and only aggravate the situation. That's the thing I think about at night, which is not a pretty picture.
Well, you've been very helpful, Robin Gamble, CEO, Persistent Telecom, and the NanoSat mobile, the NanoSat, I got to get this right, NanoSat mobile phone networks. Thank you very much for being with us.
Thank you. It's been my honor.
And as a program note here, we're definitely going to check out Robin Gamble's suggestion of checking out TeamRubiconUSA.org and see if some members of that organization can come on this program, because we're very involved with the Global Humanitarian Technology Conference in 2012 for October 21st to the 24th in Seattle, Washington. We want to give a whole lot more coverage to that on this particular program. So look for more on the Global Humanitarian Conference on this program in the coming weeks. Of course, we talk a lot on this program about energy conservation and saving and alternative energy and that sort of thing. And every once in a while, the subject of lighting comes up because we know how crucial that has been in energy conservation, with the move now to totally get rid of incandescent lights and all compact fluorescent lighting that is going on. Well, we've got with us a very interesting guest today. Carl Bloomfield is the Global Director of Business Services for Lighting at Intertek. Welcome to the program, Carl.
Thank you, and thanks a lot.
Okay, now, what's this about Intertek's ETL mark, relationship to Thomas Edison? That came out of left field for me, and I don't quite understand what that's about.
Well, if you look at the foundations of Intertek, and most labs, you know, most companies, you go back and say, we started back in X years. Mm-hmm. Intertek, the group started with Thomas Edison. So from blacking these Tesla light bulbs, that's where the company started.
Okay.
And it's kind of funny that we're talking about lighting today, but the roots, the foundations of Intertek started with Thomas Edison, his electrical Tesla lab. The acronym ETL was where Intertek started. And through the years, through growth, the parent company is now called Intertek, and the brand or the mark today is now the ETL, or still one of our marks still is an ETL mark. So we definitely, the Thomas Edison lighting is a big portion of our industry, our business line today. And it is kind of ironic that today we're talking about LED technology, new lighting technology, and we started back performance testing of light bulbs. There was a big concern back in the days that when everyone was trying to go to electricity from that, you know, the light bulbs, would it come on, would it work, the durability of it. Thomas Edison, his initial days, was testing the light bulbs for repeatability, for good manufacturing quality, and that's what we're still doing today, just new technology.
Well, the of course, there's a growing trend in energy efficiency, and lighting is a major part of that. And the growing trend for energy efficiency has affected the lighting market domestically and internationally. Can you tell us, give us a little history of that and where it's going?
Well, if you look at studies, and the Department of Energy, through their solid state lighting division, is doing a lot of studies on energy consumption. EPA is doing the same thing, trying to determine exactly where our electricity is being used today. You see a large portion, one of the larger portions is lighting. When we're at a parking garage, the lights are on in the parking garage most of the day, or offices or homes. And so lighting does consume, it is one of the larger consumers of electricity today. The industry as a whole, as we all know, is trying to figure out how to minimize pollution, how to maximize our conservation of energy. And as such, if you can minimize or better control one of the larger, what's the right word, one of the larger devices or equipment that uses that energy, then that's one of the ways to do energy conservation. The industry as a whole is definitely shifting towards more energy efficient lighting. And today, LEDs is one of the main technologies out there. We've seen a transition over the years from incandescent, back in Thomas Edison. You've gone to HID, high intensity discharge. You've gone to CFLs back in the 90s. And now you're seeing LEDs starting to take a rapid growth the late 2000s, and it's expected to be that way for the next 10 years or more. So energy-efficient lighting, if we can consume more efficiently, but yet not degrade the light quality, that is the ultimate goal of energy efficiency lighting. Right now, in North America, you see it being done a lot more aggressively with either the EPA, the utilities themselves are trying to minimize high energy consuming lights, but that trend is growing. Australia, for example, outlawed the incandescent bulb a couple of years ago.
Okay.
Canada has identified limits that they're implementing. The U.S. has identified limits that they're implementing. And this trend is eventually going to be all throughout the world, where you're going to want to have to, you'll eventually start to see the reduction in old lighting technology with a transfer to new lighting technology. This transfer does not mean that all lighting, you know, incandescent or HID is going to be completely gone, but the larger portion that consists of incandescent or HID might be, you might see a transfer from that type of technology over to an LED technology, which is supposed to be more energy efficient.
Yeah, there's a lot of complaints going from incandescent to the CFLs, the compact fluorescent lighting. People are scared what happens when a compact fluorescent light breaks and the other things that are with it. So there's a move, of course, to LED. A good friend of mine is Jerry Merriman. He developed back in the 60s the handheld calculator. And at that time, he was looking for a light source, and he looked at LEDs, but all they did is emit infrared, and nobody could see them, Jerry was telling me. But LEDs have come a long way. Is LEDs the future, and what can we expect from LED lighting?
I would say LED is the current and the immediate future. Predicting what will happen 10, 20 years from now, you know, technology, someone's always come up with something new. Today, you're seeing LED as a primary identifier for energy efficiency, but OLEDs are also the next, you know, that's the next trending thing that some are trying to push. It's another form, it's organic, so it's the next form of lighting that's being proposed. But definitely for today, LEDs is one of the forefront in terms of lighting source.
Well, we want to know a whole lot more about OLEDs, organic lighting. That's fascinating stuff. And so we're going to ask you some more about that right after the break. Carl, thanks. Okay, as we walk to the break at the half hour, we're going to pause at the door of the Den of Strangers, where we keep locked away all the wisdom of mankind. Who in the Den of Strangers will we meet today?
John Stuart Mill. The peculiar evil of silencing the expression of an opinion is that it is robbing the human race. If the opinion is right, they are deprived of the opportunity of exchanging error for truth. If wrong, They lose what is almost as great a benefit, the clearer perception and livelier impression of truth, produced by its collision with error.